And we will go on to 153127, Myers versus the Oneida Tribe of Wisconsin. Good morning.
Good morning. May it please the court. The decision reached by this court in Borms is a controlling decision with respect to whether or not the statute here, the FCRA statute, includes or applies to any government. The Borms court held it applies to any government, which means every government. So that issue is settled. So really the only remaining issue for the court to decide in this matter is whether or not an Indian tribe is a government.
You know, when Congress passed the Federal Debt Collection Procedure Act, Congress defined person to include any other public or private entity, including a state or local government, or an Indian tribe. Of course, they meant Native American. Doesn't that show that Congress knows how to include Native American tribes in these consumer protection statutes when it wants to?
That's correct. And in fact, in all of the other statutes cited by the defendant, where Indian tribes were specifically enumerated and listed, the reason why that happened is because the other governmental units that were listed in that statute were not sufficiently broad enough to include the definition of Indian tribe within them. They included such governmental units such as state or local governments, foreign counties, domestic or international associations, political subdivisions of states, national governments of foreign countries. And so under the categorical approach that the courts have adopted, none of those particular categories are sufficiently broad enough to encompass the definition of an Indian tribe.
Do you think the use of a general term is sufficiently unequivocal? I mean, for example, in 1681AB, not only does it say government or governmental subdivision, it also says or other entity. Wouldn't a tribe be an other entity? Is it your position that that would be sufficiently unequivocal to go against the presumption against waiving immunity absent a clear directive from Congress?
I think when Congress enacted this statute, they were sufficiently on notice with the dozen or so cases that we've cited, where those courts held that Indian tribes are governments. They specifically refer to them as governments, including the Supreme Court as far back as 1919.
My question, though, is other entity. Is it your position that because that's a general term that would, on its plain text, include a tribe, that that would be enough? Or do you have to look at the text in context and see how Congress has waived that immunity in the past?
I think it's important to see to deduce Congress's intent. We cannot infer their intent. We can deduce it by connecting the dots. And with respect to the phrase any government, meaning every government, you don't have to list every single state.
My question is about other entity. Can you answer that question?
I'm not sure if an Indian tribe would constitute an other entity. I don't know if that's really necessary for the decision here today. We are relying on the language of the statute that applies to every government, any government, and Indian tribes certainly are a government.
Other than the Ninth Circuit and those three bankruptcy courts, has any other federal court ever abrogated sovereign immunity for an Indian tribe without specifically using the words Indian tribe or the like?
There are a number of decisions, Supreme Court and other decisions, that involve Indian tribes as being governments. The issues in those cases were a little bit different than the facts of our case, but I would point out that the courts in those cases had to first reach the issue in many instances as to whether or not an Indian tribe was a government in order to then go on to reach the ultimate decision in the case. For example, in the Turner versus United States case, the 1919 decision, where the mob of the Creek Nation went out and caused damage, the Supreme Court first had to reach the issue of whether or not the Creek Nation was in fact a government, in order to then go on to render the ruling that there was no cause of action in that case against the nation, because there is no cause of action against a government for a failure to enforce its laws. And so if we look at that type of analysis in some of these decisions, then under the specific facts of those cases, there are courts and court decisions that have held, other than the Crystal Energy case, there are decisions that specifically had to reach the issue and specifically decided that Indian tribes were in fact governments in order to go on to the next step and render an ultimate decision.
You know, if Congress's general reference to government were enough to include Indian tribes, why in the world would Congress ever need to include the words Indian tribes after referring to governments? Why would they have to do that?
Because in some of the statutes, those statutes don't apply to all governmental units. They don't apply to, for example, foreign governments or the federal government. Some of the statutes simply apply to specifically enumerated units of government, and those specifically enumerated units of government would not allow Indian tribes to fit within that category. There are decisions that have specifically addressed that issue, where they said you don't have to say we really mean it. You don't have to list every state, you know, starting with Alaska. All you have to do is say this applies to states. So it's a categorical approach, and Congress could have certainly listed in this statute that it applies to all state and local governments, federal governments, foreign governments, and it could have enumerated them out, but it didn't have to. All it had to say was all governments, which includes all and every government.
If I said that it seems to me this is your argument, you tell me if I'm right or wrong. It seems to me that what you're arguing is the Supreme Court once referred to Indian tribes as having their own governments, Turner, 1919, as have a few other courts, a very few other courts. The Seventh Circuit has said that the FCRA applies to all governments and interpreted this to include the United States. Therefore, we must conclude that the FCRA applies to Indian tribes despite the lack of clear, unequivocal language saying so. Is that your argument?
It is, up until the point where you said despite the lack of clear, unequivocal language saying so.
I didn't get it past you. Yeah.
You know, you sue the government. You sue the government. And, for example, If a patient were injured at the VA hospital, you may sue the VA hospital, but the government comes in and substitutes in. The tribe, because it is a sovereign entity, has to be a government. Only a government can assert sovereign immunity. And in fact, in order for a tribe to be a federally recognized Indian tribe, it must function as a government under the Indian Reorganization Act. And once it's shown to do that, it has a constitution, it has the right to self-government, it can enact laws, it can enforce those laws through its in law enforcement agencies and courts, it can enforce its own laws against its own members and other non-tribal members that come onto its lands, it can engage in government-to-government relations, it can tax, it has the ability to sue under parens patriae, which Indian tribes have done, the government suing on behalf of its members.
Look, you know, in the briefs, you spent a fair amount of time arguing about the fact that the statute is one of general, applicability. But do you quarrel with the tribe's argument that a law can be applicable to a tribe, but that the tribe can nevertheless be immune from suit?
I'm sorry. I didn't want to interrupt.
I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Even though a statute is of general applicability, are you quarreling with the tribe's argument that a law can be applicable to a tribe, but that the tribe can nevertheless be immune from suit?
No, I think that's accurate. You can have a statute of general applicability, which this one is. It created a comprehensive regulatory scheme right down to the point where it governs how many digits can be printed on a receipt. So it certainly is a generally applicable statute. I don't think there's a dispute on that. The issue here is whether or not the Congress intended to waive sovereign immunity under the tribes. And that's where the balancing test comes in, where the court would look at whether or not this infringes on purely intramural matters of within the tribe itself, such as tribal membership, inheritance rules, domestic relations, and that type of test. Because what the court and Congress wanted to do is essentially strike a balance between the tribe's sovereignty and the federal government's sovereignty over those within its territory. And so there is this test that is engaged in by the courts, similar to, and that would be akin to the states ceding some of their sovereignty to the federal government in the Constitution. And so there's some safeguards built into that with 11th Amendment immunity and so forth. And this would be similar with respect to Indian tribes. There's that test to balance out the different weight of sovereignty between the entities.
Please save some of your time.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, thank you. Mr. Piper?
Yes, Your Honor, thank you. And may it please the court, Tom Piper here representing the Oneida tribe. The issue is really not whether Oneida has a government. It certainly does. And whether Oneida acts to self-govern itself as any nation, it does. The issue here is what Congress meant when it used the phrase government. And in RCRA, when it was started in 1970, when it was enacted, it only applied to credit reporting agencies and those persons who would use the credit report. Then, as Your Honor pointed out, in 1990, a new companion type of Consumer Protection Act, this time on the debt side, was passed, which was the Fair Debt Collection Procedures Act. And that broadened the number of people who would be applicable to it and defined those persons, defined the entities that would be applicable as those persons. Persons was defined to include, quote, natural person, open paren, including an individual Indian, close paren, end quote, and then, quote, state or local government or an Indian tribe. Not Indian government, but Indian tribe. So in the disjunctive, Congress was distinguishing an Indian tribe from at least state and local government. The standard is now, or then FCRA was amended in 1966, just 6 years later. And it didn't parrot the same language this time. Congress didn't. What Congress did was say, in general, governments could be subject to. So if we apply the unequivocal and unmistakable language test, does that not give rise to a question when Congress uses the word government? Is it intending to include Indian tribes? The difference between this case and Borms is, number one, Borms didn't have any issue in it as to what a government was. The United States stipulated that it was a government. And as Judge Griesbach pointed out, it naturally would. There's a big distinction between Congress passing a law that applies to governments and not thinking that it was bound by it. Of course it would. But does that mean that it's intending governments to be states, counties, municipalities, villages, in other words, just United States governments? Or is it intending to also sweep in Indian nations? And the ambiguity in that goes back to the long history of the trust relationship between the United States government and tribes. And that history distinguishes Borms here, because when there is an ambiguity in a federal statute, certainly that is going to infringe on the sovereign rights of an Indian nation, that ambiguity must be construed in favor of the tribes. Counsel said, well, but this is a very generally applicable government, and that distinguishes it from the other statutes. But it doesn't. If you look at ERISA, ERISA has a carve-out for government plans. That's all government plans. If that was intended to include Indians, there would be no reason to go farther. But instead, ERISA then defines what government plans are and includes Indian plans specifically within the definition.
Now, it does seem that there are a number of cases in which courts have defined Indian tribes as being forms of government. So what do we do with that fairly extensive body of case law? You know, starting with Turner, going into Santa Clara Pueblo, Wheeler, Inyo County, Douro, et cetera.
Well, in Santa Pueblo County, in fact, the court said that you need to tread very lightly when you're talking about a waiver of sovereign immunity. Sovereign status is different than sovereign immunity. A court may say that in this case, an Indian tribe is a government, but does that define what Congress means when it enacts a statute? Is it necessarily going to all those cases and say we can use government here? If so, why in the Safe Water Drinking Act did it include the tribes? Why did it always include CERCLA? In ERISA, when it's talking about government plans, why would it then go farther and include an Indian tribe in the definition? When you go to the Crystal Energy case here, that's the case that's relied upon because 106 of the Bankruptcy Code is an express abrogation of immunity. And it uses the phrase, governmental units will be, not just some, but governmental units will be immune, or will no longer be immune for various purposes of the Bankruptcy Code. But then it goes on to define governmental units. In its definition of governmental units, it includes all the general state and local governments, and then it has a catch-all at the end for domestic governments. And that's what the Crystal Energy Court seized on, was that additional reference to domestic government. And so did the N. Ray Russell case from Arizona, seized on that. And both said, if that had not been there, if that additional language of domestic government had not been there, the statute just referring to governmental units would have been equivocal and could not have allowed the result of thinking that Indian tribes were included. It also had an express abrogation provision, which was 106. The problem with those cases, and there are many cases that have rejected that argument, particularly the Eighth Circuit panel rejected the argument. In Whittaker, and In Re Mays rejected the argument. Greektown Holdings rejected the argument, and in National Cattle Congress, the Iowa District Court rejected the argument. But what does that lead us with? You have a general statement of domestic governments now supposedly include Indian tribes, although the United States Supreme Court generally does not refer to tribes as governments. The United States Supreme Court refers to it as a domestic dependent nation. And that's where Crystal and In Re Russell said, well, if it says domestic government, that must mean a domestic dependent nation. I don't know why. And they talk about deduction. Well, now you have the Arizona court that says you can construe this by deduction. The Michigan court in In Re Greektown says you cannot construe by deduction. It has to be specific and unequivocal. So what now you have by the mess created by under the bankruptcy code of Crystal Energy is you have Crystal Energy, the Ninth Circuit, saying a domestic government unequivocally includes Indian tribes. You have the Eighth Circuit saying, no, it doesn't. You have the Arizona court says, yes, it does. You have Michigan that says, no, it doesn't. What we have developed through that is judicial abrogation of Indian sovereignty. And that can't stand. If it's so unclear that these learned judges and these different courts are reaching different opinions on this, then it should be construed to be equivocal and ambiguous, and it has to be construed in favor of the Indian nations. And what's happening in through that and through this court, if this court were to say a general definition of government necessarily includes Indians, then it opens it up for other courts second-guessing that, and we've done away with congressional abrogation, which is where it has to be. To quote Justice Kagan in Bay Mills, it really isn't up to the judiciary to rewrite the handiwork of Congress. If this is truly, and we're having these arguments on whether Congress meant, when it used government, Indian tribes, that by itself suggests it's equivocal. And if it needs to be made more specific, it's Congress's role to do that. In fact, in the Florida paraplegic case, it talked about the ADA. And in a line of cases before then, it wasn't clear whether states' 11th Amendment had been abrogated. And so rather than the courts doing it, the Congress revisited the question, and under Title III of the ADA, specifically abrogated states' use of the 11th Amendment for purposes of the ADA. That should be what should happen here if there's really any confusion here. It's not for the judiciary to do it. Now, the other part
Let me just stop you. Oh, no, you continue.
The last thing I was going to say is, in terms of the question, even if they are governed by the law, has Congress abrogated sovereign immunity for a private right of action for money damages? And in the Florida paraplegic case, the court went down the line, and what it did was it started with the Kiowa case and in now Bay Mills case, which is you must tread very lightly, and just because there may have been an abrogation of, or there may, a statute may be of general applicability and apply to Indians, that does not necessarily mean that they are subject to a money damage claim. One of the cases relied upon by Mr. Meyer's counsel is a 2015 NLRB versus Little River Band Sixth Circuit, where the court said, Congress may choose to impose an obligation on Indian tribes without subjecting them to the enforcement of that obligation through a private right of action. The same as Florida paraplegic said, and the same as the Bassett Court said, the Second Circuit Bassett Court said in the copyright case, and all the other cases that we cited in the brief. Just because tribes, if the court were to find that tribes were governed under the general description of government or other entity provision, that doesn't mean they're subject to a money damage claim by Mr. Meyer. There has to be much more than that to show that was the congressional intent. And if the, just like in the ADA case, the Florida paraplegic case, they could be subject to government regulation, the same here. The FTA could enforce the terms of the Fair Credit Reporting Act if, in fact, the tribe were a government.
Before you sit down, I want to ask you this. How is the FCTA a statute that touches exclusive rights of self-governance in purely
intramural
matters?
First, Your Honor, that is not a test in terms of whether it is a government or even included within it or right. Any of the other part. What that is it's a Donovan or a Coeur d'Alene exception as to whether a generally applicable statute should be applied to an entity that has sovereign immunity here, whether it's an exception to that. And while we've argued that, everything up until now, we're not arguing. But here's how. In Bay Mills, it talked about the sanctity of a tribe's treasury. A tribe must be able to have the money to self-govern, to provide housing to its tribal members. And counsel on behalf of his plaintiff is seeking substantial statutory damages for a class-wide basis. And if that were to prevail, the significance of the drain on the treasury of the tribe would be substantial. And it would impede the ability of the tribe to self-govern with regard to purely intramural matters because the treasury would be depleted. And that was an issue that was discussed by, writing for the majority, Justice Kagan in the Bay Mills case. It wasn't directly on point, but it was certainly an issue she was addressing. The other exception that we talked about in the case was, or for those exceptions, was does the history here show that Congress did not intend to include Indians? And I would suggest that exception also applies because had Congress intended to include Indians, it would have done what it has done in all the other acts that we've cited, ERISA, CERCLA, RCRA, all of the other acts, and expressly specified that Indian tribes were included. It would not have done the generally applicable government standard. At the very least, we have an ambiguous statute. And based on the long history of trust between the U.S. and tribes, that ambiguity must be construed in favor of the tribes. And if it is to be cleared up, it's not to be done by a judiciary. It has to be done by Congress. Thank you.
Thank you. Do you know you said your last word just as the red light went on? How did you do that? Oh, age. Wow. Okay, Mr. Zimmerman.
Thank you. Just if I may address a few points in no particular order. There is no case that has ever held that Indian tribes are not governments. And so this court would be the first court that would be, what the defendant is asking is for this court to be the first court to make that determination and rule that Indian tribes are not governments. They're, that would be unprecedented. The definition...
Do you really mean that?
They've cited to none, and we've found none. There's been no citation in any case that's held an Indian tribe is not a government. The breakthrough management case that they rely on...
That's not really what the issue is for us, is it?
Exactly.
The issue is what Congress meant when they used the word government,
right,
and whether within the context of abrogation of immunity, is that consistent with their common practice,
right,
as applies to tribes, as opposed to us saying that tribes are or not government. That's not really what we're being asked to do, is it?
Well, right. Why I said, do you really mean that?
If
that's your argument, we're in trouble.
If an Indian tribe is a government, they're included in the definition, and you were walked through...
Only if you look at the plain text without context, which is why I asked you that question about other entity, because other entity, by its plain text, out in isolation, would include a tribe, because it's an entity. But that's not the end of our analysis. We look at the plain language in context.
Right. I don't think the other entity is sufficient to come within the bring an Indian tribe within.
Of course
the
not, because you have to look at it in context, and you have to do the same thing with the word government.
Correct, which is why we've set forth the history of the case law and the statutory change in the language of the definition in this particular statute to show that over the years, as Congress has amended this statute, they've broadened it sufficiently. So initially it was very restrictive, and then it was amended, and there were a bunch of different governmental units that were enumerated, and then it was amended again after years of case law, all holding and likening Indian tribes to governments, and it was broadened to include any government. So it was unnecessary. It would have been unnecessary surplusage to have included Indian tribes, state and local government units, the federal government, and the litany of the other governmental units again that used to be in the definition, to include them again when they amended it the last time, when they broadened the definition to include any and every government. It would have been surplusage. The legislative history argument that council has raised has specifically been rejected in Borms. And so this court doesn't have to revisit that again. The Borms held that Congress created a private right of action against any and every government. So there is a private right of action against governments under this particular statute. And the Crystal Energy decision in the Ninth Circuit should be given weight and deference. 75% of the Indian tribes are located within the Ninth Circuit. And courts have given the Ninth Circuit decisions extra weight because of that, because they face Indian tribe decisions more frequently. And if this court were to side with Crystal Energy as opposed to some of the district decisions, then there would not be a split in the circuits on this issue. Thank you.
Thank you both very much. Another very interesting argument. And the case will be taken under advisement.